bats, 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 funky little bats. Bats are the critters of the night. Fun little butterfly and bulldog bats. Bats know where everything's at.
You don't go bunky now.
Some folks, they get to screaming if they see a bat go by. Get a back and hear you as she's flying up there in the sky. She's calling out and hearing back, and she can even see. Ain't no way she isn't looking to bump into you or me. So many stories I told about her. She's the queen of Halloween. Half the stories I've told by people she has never seen.
Oh, bats, 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 funky little bats.
Bats are the critters of the night. Fun little butterfly and bulldog bats.
A little children's bat song to get us started here. During International Bat Week, we're taking an hour to talk about bats with our guest today, Heather Carica, back with us, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. And it's all about bats for the next hour, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Do you have bats living on your property? Maybe you made a bat house or built one? Give a call with your experiences or with your questions. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Heather, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Larry, and happy Bat Week.
Yeah, right in the middle of International Bat Week. Maybe we could talk to start with about global efforts to help bats out.
Yeah, you know, Bat Week and global organizations that are a really big part of that, right? So one of the main things that that Bat Week in particular is looking to do is raise awareness about how important bats are across the globe, how they benefit us, as well as just you know, how fascinating they are. And so you know, helping bats, whether it's preserving habitat or, you know, helping combat bat-specific diseases, kind of all stems from the fact that, you know, we need to let everybody know how important and how amazing these critters are.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the, well, to begin with, maybe we have what, 8 species, I believe, of bats. I know big brown, little brown. What are all the rest of them? Northern long-eared?
Yeah. So those are the kind of the big ones that people know about. So we have 8 species in Wisconsin, 4 of which are hibernators, and those are the species that you've listed, right, as well as the tricolored bat. So little brown, big brown, northern long-eared bat, and tricolored bat are the hibernating species in winter. And then we have 4 species that are migratory. They leave the state and bred about now. And head south for warmer climates during the winter. And those are the eastern red bat, the silver-haired bat, hoary bat, and then evening bat.
So how many bats do we have in Wisconsin? Of course, you probably don't know to the individual bat how many, but roughly what do we got?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And if you knew the answer to that, or we knew the answer to that, you'd know a lot more than we do. It's really hard to say for certain. Part of it stems from the fact that bats are really cryptic. They're really secretive. And so it's hard to get an estimate of, you know, how many there are, especially of the species that we aren't able to, you know, see in congregations, like in bat houses or in barns. But I can speak to, so 2 species, little brown bats and big brown bats, use barns and bat houses and other artificial structures in summer. And so we can get counts of those 2 species. So, in summer, landowners and volunteers will go out and count bats as they emerge from their roost site in the evening. You know, they're nocturnal. So we have some counts this summer at about 200 or so roost sites of both little browns and big browns. I was just looking at the numbers, and I think we have in total, I think it was 26,000 bats that were counted. So about 5,000 big brown bats in roost sites, and then that would make, you know, 20,000-ish little brown bats. And that's just in the summer. We have some counts of bats in the winter as well. Again, only of a couple species. But that's, you know, in total across all of the sites that we know of and that we monitor in Wisconsin, little bird bats are probably around 75,000.
But we're going to find bats in every county in the state, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're they have a wide range in habitat. They have a wide range in diet. Pretty much where, you know, wherever there's insects flying around, you're gonna find bats eating them.
And some callers online, but before we get to the phones, just the value of bats. We've been able to kind of monetize the value of bats in some respects. But what do they contribute to the environment? Talk about that.
Sure. So bats are really important to our agricultural systems, our food systems. They're valuable pollinators of and seed dispersers of species of, you know, foods that we eat every day, bananas and mangroves or mangoes, as well as, you know, the insectivorous bats are not only known for eating human pests like mosquitoes, but also agricultural and forestry pests as well. So they're incredibly important in, you know, in terms of, you know, removing these pests that would cause, destroy our crops, that eat our crops. And so there's been a couple, you know, studies over the years that have tried to quantify the value of, you know, if bats are eating this many, you know, agricultural pests, you don't have to spray as much pesticide. And so that that value that bats provide in terms of pest control to our ag industry is estimated, you know, somewhere between hundreds of millions to billions of dollars every year that they you know, provide us in terms of pest control.
Yeah. Amy in Wausau has a question for us. Let's go there. Amy, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, we've had bats in our ridgeline on our roof for the last few years, and we can hear them crawling up the soffits during the day. And we were planning on having them removed this fall or whenever the time frame was that it's allowed. But we haven't seen them at all this past summer. Is it possible they moved out of our house?
Yeah, I mean, we've been able to, you know, kind of monitor and watch particularly little brown bats and big brown bats because they are in folks' homes and things like that for many years. And so what we've kind of found out is that, depending on the species, some of them are more likely to, you know, they're in a site, they're just going to stay there for the summer, like they're dedicated to a specific site. So there's a primarily little brown bats. Big brown bats are a little bit more loose with their habitat selection, their roost site selection. So in general, yeah, they're gonna go back to the same site, you know, the same bat house or the same building because they know it's there, it's safe, they've been able to use it in the past. But they also might look for different conditions, right? They might need really warm sites and roost sites in, you know, May and early June when they're pregnant and when it still gets cold at night. And then they might move to a different, you know, conditions later in the summer when it's warmer. We have noticed that big brown bats are more likely to, you know, maybe use a roost site for a couple of years, or maybe only use it in, you know, certain times of year. And then they might move to shift, you know, almost as the entire colony to a different roost site. They might come back. So it is possible that they left of their, you know, their own volition. But I would still say that, yeah, they're probably going to be back. So one of the best things to do, and you might have already, you know, done this, but, you know, to watch in the evening, locate their openings, and that's where the one-way doors will go so that the bats can leave the building, but they can't get back in.
Yeah, and that's a pretty – and is it now an okay time to do that?
Yeah, so the life cycle of a bat of bats yearly life cycle of bats is such that they give birth in early June. and the at these, you know, bat house or a building in a building, and the pups who are born, the baby bat who are born in, you know, in early June are flightless for several weeks. So that's the maternity period. And so we have folks avoid exclusion, evicting bats from buildings, from June 1st to July 31st, because that's a maternity period. And that's where you run the risk of, evicting the mothers who are able to fly, and then the pups get left in the roost site. So now can be a good time. You probably, if you're just starting out the process, you probably want to do it in the shoulder season. So either, in May or after July 31st, while the bats are still active, to get that really good information about where those holes are in the building and how they're getting in and out. If you have, have that idea of where those holes are and where exactly they're getting in and out, then yeah, the now can be a good time to put up those one-way doors.
And they get through a pretty small spot. A hole the size of a dime.
Exactly. They're well, they're well adapted for squeezing into tight spaces, and basically they can fit into anywhere that they can get their head into. So that can be as small as a quarter or a dime, depending on the species.
Yeah. Amy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Number to call for you is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Do bats eat anything aside from insects?
Yeah, bats have a really, to back up, scientists recently discovered the 1500th species of bat in the world. Oh. So there's 1500 species. Across those species is a really wide range of diet. There's bats that, eat scorpions and centipedes. There's bats that eat fruit, obviously. The big fruit flying foxes are well known to eat fruit. There's bats that eat frogs. There's bats that fish, which are some of my favorite, the bulldog bats. They have these giant hind feet. And so they echolocate and they can sense, ripples on the top of the water. And then they drag their feet through the water to pick up the fish and eat the fish. There's also bats that drink blood, right? There's vampire bats. So they have a wide range of diet.
I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad and Tobago many years back now, but I remember the vampire bats there, and they don't really. There was a video that I watched that they had shown in a cattle yard or a cattle barn of a vampire bat landing on a cow, and explain what happens, because they're not really sucking the blood out, but it was really interesting to view it happening. And of course, the cow didn't even know what was going on.
Yeah, vampire bats are really fascinating, not only because they drink blood, that's their main food source, but they're also really social creatures. They're really fascinating animals. So the way they feed actually is they typically land on the ground or land near where the chicken or the cow or whatever they're going to feed on is, and they'll crawl up and they'll make a quick bite. They have really sharp two front teeth. So they make a quick bite, a little incision. They'll wait for the bat or for the animal to settle again. They actually have a little bit of anticoagulant in their saliva, which has been used for medicinal purposes, right, in medicine. So they'll wait for the animal to settle, and then they'll drink, about a teaspoon's worth of blood. They'll just lick it up. They don't actually suck. They don't have straws or anything in their teeth.
It was interesting. They had really kind of a close-up shot of a bat sort of licking with it, I guess its tongue.
Yeah, yeah.
looking up to Bud. It was really cool to see. Karen in Madison has something for us. Hi, Karen.
Yeah, thanks. I saw something really sad last summer out at the Madison School District State Forest campsite, where they have buildings where bats had gotten inside, and then somehow they put hardware cloth on the soffits, and bats tried to get out, and they got stuck in between the soffit and the hardware cloth, and they died. And there were many, many bat bodies visible, and it was just really heartbreaking. I know that one of my friends actually called DNR and reported that, but I'm wondering, is there a place that we should know about that when we see problems like this, call it bat abuse, I guess, where we can get people's attention? I don't know that this was ever addressed, you know.
Yeah. And where was it again, Karen?
Out at the school forest.
School forest. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely important to, you know, to report not only bad things that are happening to bats, but also, you know, any other animals as well. The DNR is a good place to start with. They can usually orient you to whoever, you know, needs to know and who may be able to help address it. We kind of, in this instance, right, like we kind of needed to know when it was happening in order to like and who to actually contact about, addressing it. In most cases, a lot of it is just not having enough information, right? The landowner or whoever is doing the process doesn't have enough information about how to go about safely evicting bats. In order to, you know, to actually help them, we would need to know right as it's happening in order just to contact whoever we need to contact and say, you know, we've had a report, this is what's happening, and this is how we can address it.
And in that case, a follow-up educational, it sounded like they were, we'll just put some screen up and that'll protect us from the bats, but the bats were already in there and trying to get out since there wasn't a two-way, a way to exit, they died.
Yeah, and this brings up an important, point something like International Bat Week is the goal is, right? Like education and awareness about, you know, how to get bats out of buildings or, you know, their importance is just as important as actually, you know, going about doing something like evicting bats.
So the best place, get the DNR number and call someone at the DNR to report.
Yeah, there should be, there's a, it's called Switchboard. And so Switchboard receives these calls and then they either can answer them themselves or they can orient, they can, you know, send the call along to somebody who can answer it.
Thanks, Karen, for calling. Appreciate it. Heather Karaka is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin DNR. She knows a whole lot about our bats and we're talking with her and I hope you'll join in. At 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. And just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Talking bats today with our guest conservation biologist for the Wisconsin DNR, Heather Karaka, and great to have you listening in. We'll be turning our attention to Wisconsin's reptiles and amphibians at the top of the next hour, so I hope you'll keep your questions or save your questions on them for a little later, but right now it's bats, and Helen in Madison has a question. Hi, Helen.
Oh, hi, and hi, Heather. I'm one of the I have bats at my house that they come and monitor, so that's pretty cool. But Heather, I was wondering, like, I know a little bit more about the brown bats and little browns and big browns, but I don't know anything about the others. Are they in southern Wisconsin? Where are they? What kind of habitat do they live in? Like, do they live in houses, or do they stay in colonies, or do they just individuals that hang out, or how does it work?
Yeah, that's a good question. How much time do you have? So the two species, the reason that we know about little browns and big browns is because they are kind of the only ones who we find, at least in Wisconsin, using bat houses and buildings. So we know a fair amount about them and their roosting habitats. But the other six species, we've done some research in the past and done things like radio tracking, particularly northern long-eared bats and tricolored bats, because they are the two other species that are known to get white nose syndrome and known to be particularly hard hit by the disease. So we've done a little bit of research on them, and they do form small colonies, not hundreds or thousands of bats the way the little browns and big browns do. But before white nose syndrome was here, we had colonies of 2 to 10 or maybe 15 northern long-eared bats and tricolored bats. The rest of the species who don't use buildings and artificial structures are using trees to roost in summer, and they're really tricky to find. Bats are really good at being cryptic and being secretive, and so that's why we don't know a ton about them. And for instance, the tricolored bats are using leaf clusters. They might find a cluster of dead or live oak leaves that have kind of folded down, and they'll roost in those. The northern long-eared bats are good at exploiting cracks and crevices in trees, whether it be an actual cavity in a tree, a live or dead tree, or peeling bark. They like to get under peeling bark of dead trees. The migratory species also use trees. They tend to be a little bit more solitary, particularly the hoary bats and the eastern red bats. In other areas, the evening bat, who we only know of a couple places where they are at this point in Wisconsin, but evening bats in other parts of the United States that are found will form colonies, and they might use buildings, but they also use trees. And then the other three species of migratory bats tend to be a little bit more solitary, and they're definitely tree roosters.
So lots of bats and trees.
Lots of bats and trees. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Helen, thanks for calling. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much. I have a question about bats, and I've never seen a dead bat. So do they have enemies? I don't know who goes, chases them and kills them and whatever. And the second question is, do bats battle each other? One cave bats versus, 10 miles away, another one. Do they ever war with each other?
Yeah. Okay. Battling bats. And who are the bat predators, Heather?
Both really good questions. Yeah. So bat predators, so bats are nocturnal. Most bats are nocturnal, right? So they've exploited this nocturnal niche. And so they could have done that probably because there are fewer predators, right, at night, especially flying around. So we have seen, owls occasionally pick off bats. But if a bat happens to be flying during the day, which we have seen, they are very vulnerable to things like hawks. If they happen to be out during the day or flying in the early evening and the hawks are still out and about, they can definitely get predated by hawks. The most frequent predation happens when they're congregated in an area, when they're coming out of a hibernation site or swarming around a hibernation site in fall. When they're mating, a lot of times these entrances to these hibernation sites are constricted, they're small, and so they have to fly through an area. And so they can also be predated by things like feral cats or raccoons. Snakes sometimes will pick off bats. I actually just saw a video of a rat in Germany catching a bat and eating it. But whether they are territorial at all, that's a really Good question. We don't have a ton of information on their social structures. They obviously are very social, right? They form colonies in summer. And lots of times they might be unrelated. And then they also congregate in winter. Now, whether that has to do with the fact that there's only a few suitable sites in the area that can safely house bats in winter, and so they just happen to go to these sites because that's where the only places they can go, or whether there's something more social happening, we don't really know. But as in terms of territoriality, we don't see a ton of evidence that they are territorial and that they will fight each other. But there's probably, instances of that. We just haven't seen it.
Yeah. Mike, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Marty in Lake Geneva, let's go to you now. Hi, Marty.
Hey, Lara, thanks for taking my call. I'm going to preface this comment that this occurred 12 to 13 years ago. Summer night, windows are open, screens. Walked in my son's bedroom. Here's a bat doing laps around the ceiling. So second or third lap, I swat at it. It comes, lands on the bed. I put a pillow on it. My wife comes up, gives me a Tupperware container. I take it to a nature center or extension, whatever it was, with the premise or the thought being that, okay, well, they're going to find out if this is rabid or not. If it's not, they're going to let it go. That wasn't how it worked back then. In order to do that test, they had to distance its head from its body. So has that changed since then? And I'll listen to the response off air. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. That's a good question. So the, what the caller is referring to is testing the bat for rabies, which is certainly something important to think about and something to, that may have to happen. Unfortunately, they have to, the State Lab of Hygiene, who tests for rabies in bats and other animals, has to test the brain stem. So unfortunately, in order to test for whether the bat has rabies or not, they have to safely euthanize it and then test the brain stem. So that hasn't changed. There's unfortunately no way, to test live animals for rabies.
And I would just add that my mother, Reva Mueller, rest her soul, was the person that at the State Lab of Hygiene that was the first person for testing for rabies back about the time that he was talking about. So there's no, it was tested for rabies and all kinds of animals and not only bats. And that's the unfortunate way it works. Sylvia in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I was able to get proof this year for Greg Septon, who monitors the We Energy's Falcon boxes, that the one peregrine was very adept at catching bats during the day. He brought in at least 6 or 9 bats total for the year.
Wow.
Where was this? In Madison?
No. This is the one in Port Washington.
Port Washington. Okay. Yeah. I wonder if he had found the place where they're roosting, actually, where the bats are roosting. So bats do occasionally fly during the day, particularly in, early in the season when there might be more insect activity and it might be warmer, in March than it is in the evening, and they might have more success. So we do, occasionally see bats flying around during the day and in earlier in the season. But especially over the summer, they know that they should be out, at night. So I wonder if the peregrine falcon had found somewhere the bats were roosting, maybe in a building, and he was getting into the building and figuring out how to flush them and catch them that way. That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, Sylvia, thanks a lot. But I think you're right, Heather. Probably found a roost area and had a kind of a steady meal there. We are talking bats again with Heather Karaka from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, where she is a conservation biologist. And if you join in with your questions or comments about bats as well, number to call 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. You know, our Wisconsin Life team, Maureen McCallum, put together a little program about bats. And this might be a good time to listen into it. It's titled A Dance of 3,000 Bats, Watching the Morning Swarm at Nelson Dewey State Park. Beatrice Lawrence.
The Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin offers hundreds of field trips each year that bring members face-to-face with some of the state's natural wonders. WPR's Beatrice Lawrence went along on a trip to Nelson Dewey State Park along the Mississippi River to witness a swarm of 3,000 bats put on a show as they returned to their homes at dawn.
It's 4 a.m. and dark. Paul White greets about 20 people. He's the bat program lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation.
Must be a lot of birders here. You guys are ready to go.
Yeah. The group finds their seats and waits quietly for the show to start. As the sun slowly rises, we begin to see the bats dancing. This field trip to Nelson Dewey State Park was organized by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit that works to protect the state's lands, waters, and wildlife. This weekend, the group is camping to see the Stonefield colony of bats as they emerge to feed at sunset. They'll also witness the bats return as a swarm at dawn, all 3,000 of them.
So it's the beauty of morning swarm that we really want to be able to show people, and that's why this field trip is special.
That's Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. She says she enjoys giving people the opportunity to get up close and personal with an animal that's often misunderstood or unnoticed.
But it's one of the most beautiful and mysterious wildlife phenomena that happen every morning in the summer, outside every major bat roost across the state, and people don't know about it. And it's this really cool way to experience bats up close.
Each year, the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin organizes hundreds of these trips to get people in touch with the natural world and show them conservation projects in action. Riddell says this trip is especially powerful, and that people might even come out the other side as bat lovers.
Because nobody wants to get up at 4 in the morning.
Multiple times.
Right. To watch bats. Until you've seen swarm, and then you're addicted. I've got to go see that again.
This expedition is full of field trip veterans, like Henry Nels Lowe of Fitchburg.
They are amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah, they are. All of them are fabulous. I've got a monarch tagging coming up. Hummingbird tagging is coming up. I've just seen so many remarkable things, gone out just learning about different places I've never been.
Against the sunrise, thousands of little brown bats fly around our heads. There's so many, it's a wonder they don't hit each other, or us. The DNR's Paul White prepared us for this moment.
Just close your mouth.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the bat kiss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Last night, the bats left their homes and flew away immediately to eat. But this morning, the bats take their time returning to their boxes. The swarm grows as they dance around each other, occasionally squabbling or flying smack into the side of the boxes. As the bats finally make their way back into their boxes, it falls silent. People like Alex Ellman of Appleton are in awe.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was crazy when you started to realize how many bats were underneath the houses swarming. Because there were so many, and it was almost like they would come at you and then split, kind of like the Red Sea, and then circle around. And then all of a sudden, as it got a little bit lighter, I was like, oh my God, there's so many bats. It was so cool.
The bats are finally settled in for the morning.
They're probably wondering where the nearest coffee shop is.
And the humans, we have the whole day ahead of us. Coffee will help, but seeing the bats' morning swarm, no amount of caffeine can energize you like that.
WPR's Beatrice Lawrence brought us that story on bat viewing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Kind of a cool feature. Heather, have you been part of watching one of those swarms and dances?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really amazing thing to witness, especially when it is thousands of bats, right?
It was great to listen. Edison, Sun Prairie has a question that relates obviously to bats, so let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering, you know, we talked about how the insect populations are down, and I noticed there aren't a lot of moths and things flying around at night, and I was wondering how that is affecting the bat populations, and do you work with entomology to, you know, kind of monitor that?
Insect populations. The effect of declining insect populations on our bats. Heather.
Yeah, that's a great question and you know, an important thing to investigate and point out. There are insect declines across the globe and in, you know, most taxa groups, which obviously can have cascading effects if there's not enough to eat for not only bats, but also birds. You know, it can obviously have some detrimental and potentially even population declines. In Wisconsin in particular, because we have the most information about big brown bats and little brown bats and their population sizes, the kind of the overwhelming force at play has been white nose syndrome. So white nose syndrome arrived, and it's a fungal disease. It arrived in, you know, Wisconsin in 2014. And just like across the continent where it had come into hibernation sites, it caused mass mortality, right? We lost anywhere from 75 to 100% of the bats in these hibernation sites. And so, you know, with declines in insects in the last, 10 to 15 to 20 years, it's been kind of difficult to tease out what that, impact might be, declining food sources, because there has been this huge, impact from this fungal disease, white nose syndrome. It's certainly something that we'll need to investigate in the future and keep monitoring. Because just like disease and just like habitat loss, yeah, if they lose their food sources, bats can definitely be impacted by something like declines in insects and declines in their food sources. And we do work not particularly closely with entomologists, but yeah, it's certainly something that there is, you know, obviously overlap, right? Because that's what our bats eat. So we have worked with entomologists in the past and looking at that.
Heather Carrick, our guest today, conservation biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. A question about bats or comment, maybe an experience to share, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking bats today with Heather Carica of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Great to have her with us. Tom emailed us. Heather, Thompson has an old Victorian house, and every year seems to get a couple of bats spending the winter in quiet places on the third floor. While unpacking Christmas decorations, they sometimes accidentally wake them up. And Tom's wondering, are they okay? Would they need to eat or drink? Tom doesn't mind them there. There seems to be just a few. How can Tom help them, or will they just go back to sleep?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually a fairly common occurrence, particularly the Christmas decorations. It's always funny to hear stories. Yeah, folks will they go up into their attic in December and pull the lights down and the decorations down, and yeah, there's a bat in the box or there's a bat under the box. So it's not it's not terribly uncommon to find this species is big brown bats. Big brown bats are kind of the only ones that we know of who are able to. Because they're a little bit larger and they're a little bit hardier, they're able to hibernate in buildings and in conditions that, you know, other species can't hibernate in. And so it's the normal torpor or hibernation cycle for bats is to, they might wake up every week or every couple weeks. They might move around. They might get a drink of water. So folks actually who have them, you know, hibernating in their house will find them in sinks or in buckets or even in their toilet, when they're looking for water. But they are very well adapted to, waking up from torpor and then being able to go back into hibernation. So, if you are waking them up every day or every other day, it might be a concern. And in that case, the bat would probably, leave the site and go find another place to hibernate. But, them getting disturbed once a month or once or twice over the winter probably isn't having huge impacts on their ability to hibernate through the winter.
Excellent. Let's go to Randy and Ripon next. Hi, Randy.
Hi, I was just wondering if there's an effect on bats, because I know bats eat insects, and, the use of chemicals for bugs and all that, whether it's egg or homeowner, if they're eating, poison bugs, does that have an effect on them, or is that really not an issue?
Yeah, good question. There can be an effect. So the way bats and not only hibernators who need to build up fat reserves to be able to survive hibernation throughout the winter, but also the migratory species will gain some weight before they make their migration. They eat a lot throughout the summer and then into the fall as they're gaining those fat reserves. And if there's a particularly large amount of, insecticide or something like that on these insects that they're foraging, there can be a bioaccumulation. So the insecticide and the pesticide can accumulate in the fat, and then as they burn off the fat, the insecticide kind of stays in their system. And there has been some research on this. The bats are really hard to study because they're hard to keep in captivity. They're long lived. And so the effects, over time of, what accumulation of pesticides and chemicals can have on bats is not particularly well understood. But there has been some research that's shown, they can have some birth defects and can cause some problems with pregnancy and things like that.
Yeah. Bruce, thanks a lot for calling. You mentioned lifespan. How long do they live?
That varies by species. So if you think about a bat and its size, they're about roughly the size of a rodent, right? A mouse or maybe a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller. And rodents, mice live maybe a year or two if they're lucky. Bats, maybe because they're in hibernation and they can slow their metabolism down, can live many years. So little brown bats, an average lifespan is, 10 to 15, maybe 20 years. But there is an extreme end of that for little browns. I think the oldest little brown on record is 34 or 35 years old.
Wow.
We actually in Wisconsin have a record of a bat who was found in a hibernation site in Wisconsin at 32 years old. They can live a long time, and some of the other species don't live quite as long. Something like a big brown bat is maybe like 8 to 12 years. Because they're hard to study, we don't have a great sense of exactly how long they live on average.
I wanted to go back, speaking of living, I wanted to go back to white nose syndrome. I saw some reports that it sort of has eased a bit, or was that mistaken?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So, again, white nose syndrome is a fungal disease. It affects bats as they're hibernating in winter. It arrived in Wisconsin in 2014, and we were fortunate in that we had some, you know, baseline information about population, you know, sizes, particularly of little brown bats and big brown bats, even before the disease got here, because we knew it was coming. Then we had information, you know, folks were monitoring as the disease invaded, and now that it's endemic in the area. So what we kind of saw was, we didn't escape the big population declines, mortality from the disease, particularly of little brown bats. So what we saw was, you know, steady populations before white nose got here, huge crashes, again, 75% to 100% in particularly in hibernation sites. We saw, though, after, you know, the first few years of infection, things start to stabilize, albeit at, you know, much lower levels than were before the disease got here. And then in the last couple of years, at least for little brown bats, we've started to see some growing populations and increasing both in particularly in summer sites, but also in a few of our winter sites as well. Now, whether that's, these are bats that are obviously surviving white nose syndrome. They're hibernating in sites where the disease has been, where the fungus is, and they probably contract the syndrome, contract the disease, and then they're able to fight it off in summer. So whether that, the seeming immunity is due to the individual bats themselves, right? Something about them and their physiology, or whether it's something about the winter sites where, you know, the fungus can't grow quite as well or doesn't grow quite as well, or they're just, you know, simply adapting to, being able to survive and figuring out how to hibernate with fungal infection is really unknown. But there's been quite a bit of research on white nose syndrome in Wisconsin, thanks to USGS National Wildlife Health Center, as well as to professors from Virginia Tech University who have come and done long-term research on white nose syndrome.
And just to wind up here in the last 30 seconds or so, what during International Bat Week, what should we do as individuals relating to bats? What can we do to help?
Sure. I mean, so probably the best thing that you know, the average everyday person can do is, educate yourself and how amazing bats are and how beneficial they are, how important they are, and then spread that awareness, right? Spread that fascination and that excitement about bats, because, excitement about something, you know, really cool is infectious, right? It can spread really easily. But there are some other things you can do too, right, to help, kind of your local bats. One of those is to, build bat habitat and build a bat house and place it. And there's information on, building bat houses on the DNR website if you search for bats on the website.
It's a pretty good set of instructions. Heather, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much. You'll come back and be with us again.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
Heather Carrick, conservation biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Great to have her with us today. She does a wonderful job and fun learning more about bats during International Bat Week. Coming up, we're going to learn a little bit more about amphibians and reptiles that are crawling around Wisconsin. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Bats, funky little bats. Bats are the critters of the night. Fun little butterfly and bulldog bats. Bats know where everything's at. They don't go bump me out. Some folks, they get to screaming if they see a bat go by. Get a back and hear you as she's flying up there in the sky. She's calling out and hearing back, and she can even see. Ain't no way she isn't looking to bump into you. So many stories are told about her. She's
the queen of Halloween. Half the stories are told by people she has never seen. Ow! Bats, 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 funky little bats. Bats are the critters of the night. Fun little butterfly and bulldog bats. Bats know where everything's at. They don't go bumpy, you know.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And on the show right now, we're going to take a look at the amphibians and reptiles that call Wisconsin home with our guest back with us once again, Josh Kapfer. He's a certified wildlife biologist, a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Whitewater, and is the co-editor, along with Donald Brown, of the book Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. Absolutely amazing book. I don't know what you're going to learn pretty much everything you want to learn about amphibians and reptiles of Wisconsin by taking a look at that book. But he's here to impart what he knows, a little of what he knows about amphibians and reptiles with you right now. And I hope you'll join in. Tell us about your maybe favorite amphibian or reptile. Let us know your questions about snakes or frogs or toads or salamanders. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Josh Kapfer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here.
I got to ask you about that. How did the book do? I mean, that book.
Yeah. As far as numbers sold, I guess I don't know exact numbers sold, but UW Press said that it did really well. And, you know, they're a small publisher and a nonprofit publisher. And so it really did well for them. They're very excited about it. And in fact, they've asked us to create a smaller field guide version, a pocket field guide version that we've completed and hopefully will be out in 2027.
Oh, man, we'll want to talk to you about that when it comes out, I for sure. Well, tell us about the amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin. And we've got pretty good numbers of each, I believe.
Yeah, so what I often tell people is that we have a sort of nice diversity or species richness of amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin. It's manageable. You get further south in the U.S. and they far, far exceed our numbers. I mean, I lived in North Carolina for 2 years, and the number of salamanders alone in North Carolina is staggering, you know. But we have a manageable diversity, enough that I can teach a weekend workshop and cover all of them. And so we do have a really nice diversity. And, you know, we are located, Wisconsin is located geographically in such a way that we have a lot of natural sort of barriers. We have the Great Lakes around us that create certain habitats. We have major rivers in the Wisconsin and the Mississippi that create areas. We have an unglaciated region, the Driftless region. We're influenced by the Great Plains to the west. We've got the eastern deciduous forest that is in the north and the far east. So we've got really, really cool diversity based on adaptations to the fact that all of these communities exist.
John wants to know, what's the difference between amphibians and reptiles?
That's a great question. So amphibians, generally speaking, have very moist skin that's also very thin. So these amphibians can absorb both moisture, water through their skin. They don't have to necessarily imbibe water or drink water through their mouth. And they can actually absorb oxygen. They can breathe through their skin to a degree. And in fact, that's taken to an extreme by some of our salamander species. They're in the family Plethodontidae. We have the four-toed salamander and the redback salamander. They are in a group called the lungless salamanders. They don't have any lungs. They just absorb oxygen through their skin. Reptiles have thicker skin and they have scales that are keratin or similar to like fingernail material, and they can't breathe through their skin. They can't really absorb oxygen effectively through their skin like amphibians do. They also have hard-shelled eggs, reptiles do, that have to be laid on land. So turtles, even though they live in the water, most of them have to come on land to lay their eggs as reptiles. And amphibians have eggs more like fish eggs, where they're sort of gelatinous and can be laid in the water.
So a skink is, for example, would be a reptile, would it not? And the
correct.
And the salamander, of course, an amphibian. A skink will lay, its eggs are, I think, have a coat, a hard, a shell, I should say.
Yes, they do. And that shell, it's not quite as hard as a bird shell. It's kind of leathery, so it's a little bit pliable and flexible, but it is not at all like you can imagine what, if you've ever seen caviar, what caviar looks like is similar to what amphibian eggs would look like, sort of gelatinous and look like they'd be very vulnerable.
See, Cater in Herbster has a question, I believe, or a comment at least. Let's go there. Hi, Cater.
Hey. I've seen a lot of snakes in my life, but one time I was walking down a sunny road and there was a small garter snake sunning, and I walked up towards it, and I don't know if I was hallucinating or what, but, you know, snakes move in a serpentine way, but it went backwards, serpentine, into the grass, and I didn't even think that was possible. Have you ever seen such a thing?
Oh.
Did it back up, or are you sure you were looking at the head when it was on the road, or were you, you know what I mean? Was it facing towards you for certain?
No, it was, and I know their scales point backwards, and that when they go serpentine, that's what grabs. So yeah, I was like, what's happening here? And I looked at it again, and yeah, the head was moving left.
Okay. So it's possible that, especially if it was if you saw the entirety of the snake body on the road, then obviously backing up in the exact pattern it came out with would be a little more difficult, but not impossible. However, if you saw maybe just part of the snake on the road and the rest of it was back up in the grass, for example, it's a lot easier to imagine that it would just slowly slip its way backwards into that grass. So they can definitely sort of move themselves backwards in a similar serpentine fashion. They tend not to move prolonged periods of time in that fashion, however.
Really interesting. Thanks, Gator. Appreciate the call. Fran in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, yeah, I'm curious. We live by a wetland and we're overwhelmed with mosquitoes over the summer. If there are any reptiles or amphibians that we can look out for that would be mosquito eaters, potentially?
Sure. Many of the amphibians in both their adult phases and their larval phases will eat lots of mosquitoes or mosquito larvae. So salamander larvae, for example, are well documented to eat huge numbers of mosquito larvae. So when I say larvae, I mean amphibians. Obviously, they hatch from eggs in the water. They have a larval juvenile form. That is usually, there are some exceptions, but usually they have this fully aquatic larva form that hangs out in the water, swims around, they have gills, and then they metamorphose and they turn into a more terrestrial adult, typically. So as larvae, the juvenile form, salamanders are well-known voracious predators of lots of insects, anything they can fit in their mouths. And in fact, they sometimes sort of compare them to top predators, like a wolf is a top predator in an ecosystem in Yellowstone, but in these tiny little wetland ecosystems, larval salamanders are the top predator, like the wolf of those wetlands. So they eat lots of juvenile or larval salamanders. And then adult frogs, gray tree frogs and things like that are well known for being insectivorous. So they also eat a lot of mosquitoes. Now they eat a lot of other insects as well. They don't just focus on mosquitoes, but they do eat lots of mosquitoes.
Yeah. Fran, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Carl in Eagle River, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a question. I was traveling in South Dakota, and it was way past midnight on a hot, rainy day. And just like night crawlers come out at night, there were thousands and thousands of salamanders all over the road. And I've never seen anything like that. I was wondering if you could explain that.
Sure. Depending on what time of year it was, I'm not sure exactly what time of year this was, but usually there are two periods where we would expect to see big migrations of things like salamanders. So in the spring, they have a tendency to overwinter or spend the winter in upland areas to get below the frost line. And then when it gets warm, they come out and they all migrate en masse towards a wetland, and they have to breed in those wetlands typically. And then at the end of the season, when it might be hotter, like the situation you experienced, All of those larvae that I mentioned before metamorphose, and they turn into closer to an adult salamander with legs, and they come out of the water and breathe with lungs. And then they all migrate en masse to go back to the upland area where they overwinter or they spend the winter. So it was likely the latter situation that you observed, and rainy nights are really good for that, right? That's when they're not going to dry out. So that's that tends to be when you see a lot of those mass migrations happening.
And we get that at least on a different level here in Wisconsin. Even in Madison, there are salamander watch groups. Are there not?
Yes, absolutely. And there are groups that will go out. Now, you have to be very careful about doing things on roads at night because there is the potential to be injured or by vehicles. But there are people that go out and help these salamanders across roads when they're migrating, because you can imagine that results in a heavy toll on populations if they're trying to cross those roads going from the wetland to the upland or vice versa. But absolutely. And the Wisconsin DNR, actually on their webpage associated to amphibians and reptiles, they have areas where you can track, you can report road crossings that are in potentially having that you think might be having an impact. So the DNR likes to know about those things so they can try and monitor those populations.
Carl, thanks again. Appreciate it. Bob in Superior, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Many years ago, I was walking across a small lake during deer season, no snow, very clear ice, 8-10 inches of perfectly clear ice, and I saw in, you know, water that was maybe 6-8 feet deep several times, I saw painted turtles swimming under the ice. It made me think that they must be able to absorb oxygen through their skin. But did I disturb them? Did I put them into an oxygen debt?
That's a great question. So a couple of things. First, I mentioned that generally reptiles can't absorb oxygen through their skin. There are some exceptions to that. For example, turtles that overwinter underwater, there are some species that can absorb oxygen through tissues that line their oral cavity. And there are some species that can also absorb oxygen through the lining of their anus. So they call that anal breathing. So it is possible that that can happen. And then, you know, a lot of times if they're in areas in water bodies that have access to the surface, that surface water gets well oxygenated better. Like if there's not a solid covering of ice on top of it, that oxygen can better get into the water for them to be able to absorb it through those areas of their skin. But turtles can also use an anaerobic metabolism, it's called, which means they can metabolize and get energy without the need for oxygen. Now, remember, in the winter, they're moving really, really slow. Their metabolism slows way down because they are cold-blooded or ectothermic. So they don't have as big of a metabolic need as they would if they were active. So they don't need as much energy. And so they can burn energy without the use of oxygen. But they can only do that for so long. Now, whether you disturbed it or not and caused an oxygen deficit, it's hard to say. Typically, if turtles don't want to move in those situations, if they're really, really cold, they're slowed down, then they don't move. So while I can't say for certain if you caused that, it seems to me that if they were moving around, they must have felt they had access to enough oxygen.
Bob, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Christy in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thank you. A few years back, I was at a June meeting of teachers and looked out the window at break and saw a gorgeous timber rattlesnake moving across the parking lot headed towards a street. I grabbed the box, went out, was able to get the snake, bring it home, release it later in the day in the wooded lot. And another participant in the in service said, oh, you can have that snake. My husband wants it to eat the moles. And she had driven from Bloomer that morning to Chippewa. So can a snake ride on the undercarriage of a truck? It would be warm, of course, and a nice place for a snake to be. What do you think?
Well, so it is potentially feasible that that could happen. Sure. It's not completely outside of the realm of possibility, and it's documented in species to be accidentally translocated inside of the, you know, mechanism of a vehicle, as long as they're not next to a moving part or something that would burn them, like direct contact to the exhaust, that's feasible. So Chippewa is, Chippewa Falls. So that would be, which county is that? I can't think off the top of my head. Chippewa County, sorry. So that would be close to the potential range for that species. They usually are found within the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys, and they really need sort of rocky outcroppings and rocky bluffs to be found or to exist. They need those types of habitats. It's possible that they could be translocated in a vehicle like that. I don't hear of many documented cases of it with timber rattlesnakes in the upper Midwest, but it's inside the realm of possibility.
Yeah. Christy, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Having some fun today and an interesting time with Josh Kapfer, a certified wildlife biologist, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Whitewater, as we talk with him about our frogs, salamanders, snakes. It's great fun. And you can join in. I hope you will. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Experience to share or question to ask? Join on in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at amphibians and reptiles with our guest, Josh Kapfer, of the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, where he is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Renata in Lake Mills has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Renata.
Hi, thank you for having this show. I have a question about mud puppies in the state and how the population is doing. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
So mud puppies are an interesting species. They're a salamander, and so they're also one that, you know, often people who are looking for salamanders aren't looking for salamanders where you find mud puppies, because mud puppies are fully aquatic. So we find them in riverine habitats. We find them in lakes. And that's not generally where you're looking for salamanders. You're looking for salamanders in, you know, ephemeral wetlands and woodlands and things like that. So where we were getting, or where we have gotten the best data on numbers of mud puppies, is from fisheries biologists, because they're generally doing survey work for fish in bigger water bodies, and they bring mud puppies up when they're doing the survey work. And so there have been many of the amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin, we have poor population data on, but we have been trying to accumulate a better understanding about mud puppy populations in the state. And to get an idea, it seems as if their numbers are somewhat declining, but we don't have really good population data on that yet. However, the DNR has been active in a project involving mud puppies in the Milwaukee River. So hopefully there'll be more information on them specifically in that part of southeastern Wisconsin soon.
I was thinking back while you were talking, when I was probably around 9 years old, I was fishing with some pals and caught a mud puppy. And I had never seen one. I didn't know anything about them. It scared the heck out of me when I was expecting to pull up a bluegill or something, and here comes a mud puppy.
Yeah. So honestly, where I have caught them, there's one or two instances where I've been out specifically looking for mud puppies. But where I have caught them has been with friends ice fishing, pulled them up through the ice because they're active in the winter. And then also electroshocking for fish and doing fish surveys. We've shocked up mud puppies. So they're really a cool salamander. They're our biggest salamander, you know, the of all of them. The tiger salamander is the biggest terrestrial one. Yeah, they can get good size. With tail, they could even get bigger than that. So they're a very good sized critter. And you would, you know, treat or find them in places where you would be fishing, not infrequently. So,
and later on in life, I think my dad gave me a mud puppy bait for muskie fishing. So I guess muskie will eat a mud puppy if they've come across.
That's what they say, you know. And in fact, there are, you know, a lot of it are anecdotal one-off reports, but there are numerous reports of fish species that have mud puppies in their gullets, right? So they're a food source for a number of different fish, and they have a tendency to hang out towards the bottom. Mud puppies do, or hang out in rocks and riprap. So the things that kind of move around in those locations, we can easily envision eating mud puppies.
Brian in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Hey, great show.
Thank
you. Fun to hear about these little-known creatures. Hey, I would like to know a little bit more about slender glass lizards. I understand they're a legless lizard that lives in Wisconsin.
You are absolutely correct, and they are one of my favorite critters. We only have four salamander species here in Wisconsin, and so the legless... this slender glass lizard is a legless lizard. It has some of the bony elements like a pectoral girdle and shoulder girdle that we would imagine legs attaching to, but they don't have these limbs. And so they basically are, without knowledge, look indistinguishable in some cases from a snake. But there are a couple of ways in which you can tell a legless lizard from a snake. First of all, lizards blink, right? So snakes do not have eyelids. So if you get close enough to it and you can see it blinking its eye, then you know that it is a legless lizard. It's a lizard of some type. Also, lizards have external pores or openings for their ears, whereas snakes don't have that. So you can see those on a legless lizard. Then there's some other things, you know, the legless lizard has a really, really long tail compared to a snake, but you have to be able to look at where the vent is, where they go to the bathroom out of, and what proportion of that is the body. But the reason why they're called a glass lizard is because they have the ability to dislocate their tails in different fragments if necessary. And then that tail piece that breaks off keeps wiggling. And so that distracts the predator just long enough for that glass lizard, which is really fast typically, to shoot forward and get away. So it's a really, really interesting, fascinating lizard species here in the state. It is an endangered species, too, only found in a very small pocket of Wisconsin. And then it doesn't show up again until down into central Illinois. So this huge gap between where they are in Wisconsin and where they are elsewhere in the upper Midwest.
Just overall, what's the status of our amphibians and reptiles in the state overall?
Yeah, so overall, we see... We have certain species that are listed as threatened and endangered at the state level. Some are also our potential federal candidates or our federal candidates. Those species are struggling, right? The one that always leaps to mind is the Massasauga, the eastern Massasauga, one of our two rattlesnake species here in Wisconsin. And that one, you know, at one point in time, historic records indicate that it was massively abundant in certain parts of the state. I mean, here in Walworth County, where I am, there are records of huge numbers of quote-unquote rattlesnakes, which, given our location, would have to be Massasaugas and not timber rattlesnakes. And today, you couldn't find a Massasauga in Walworth County. There's just a handful of sites where they currently still exist. But then there are other species that seem to be holding stable. Now, remember, we don't have great population data on these types of organisms for comparison. They're not a game species, generally speaking. So we don't have number data like we do for white-tailed deer or, you know, recreationally harvested fish, for example, where we have better population information. But some of those common species, your American toads, your common garter snakes, they seem to sort of be holding steady. But the ones that are rare continue to be rare. We don't see a lot of improvement there. And the ones that are on the fence, we kind of worry about tipping towards that greater decline. And a lot of that is related to loss of habitat and fragmentation of habitat.
Scott in Elko, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a koi and goldfish pond outside my house, and this year I never had any bullfrogs show up after the ice went out. Can you explain why that is? Every year I've always had a dozen bullfrogs in there, but not this year.
Okay, so just to confirm, after the ice melted in the spring, there were bullfrogs that came out of the pond?
No, that came out of the woods. The ones that were in the pond, I have a rubber liner in it, so everything that was in the pond was dead, but they show up from someplace, so they did not come from the pond.
Oh, okay. So, well, it's hard to know. Usually in the... So, first and foremost, bullfrogs and the very closely resembling green frog here in Wisconsin has to overwinter underwater. So some of our frogs can spend the winter kind of buried in certain places on land, but bullfrogs and leopard frogs and green frogs have to overwinter in the water. So if they are in an environment that freezes solid or if they completely run out of oxygen, then that could result in their mortality during the winter. So the ones that come in, I would assume, are coming from some sort of adjacent water body, and why they didn't come in this year as opposed to other years would potentially have to do with if it was a particularly harsh winter, or if more of them got froze over the winter than normal and there wasn't as many to migrate the distance to your koi pond in the spring. If there was some sort of landscape change that maybe is subtle but you're not aware of, like there's a widening of a road somewhere, or there's a new housing development goes in that might restrict their migration. But if you're close to a water body, bullfrogs tend not to move massive distances to find water bodies in the spring. They have a tendency to sort of stay in the water body they overwinter in.
Scott, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I was thinking back to Scott Craven, who has a pond as well that he made. This probably sounds a little like what Scott had from Elko, but he has no water anywhere close to his house and gets a bullfrog every year, somehow finds its way.
Yep. And I mean, that absolutely can happen. Where I am, we're sort of in the same situation. We have this tiny, tiny little pond in our backyard that was dug in by a previous landowner. We don't have a ton of permanent water nearby, but all summer we have juvenile green frogs that live in that pond, and they're one that need to overwinter in the winter in water. So these juveniles are probably more likely or more prone to migrate, right? They are more likely to go to a new location, and that maybe is when they would run into these other littler wetlands that we find them in sometimes.
Let's talk a little more about frogs for a moment. You know, we have 12 species, I think, of frogs. Mm-hmm. And
around there, yeah.
And the in general, the frog populations are kind of following what?
So we have one species here in Wisconsin that is currently listed as endangered at the state level, and that is the Blanchard's cricket frog. And that frog is rare. It has very unique habitat needs, especially for overwintering. And so that likely is what is restricting it currently, although we're not entirely sure, because this was another species that existed in massive numbers, even into the 50s and 60s in southern Wisconsin, and then suddenly started to experience this huge decline. So there are some, you know, hypotheses of why that happened, but that would require a little bit more of an in-depth discussion. There are other species that we see holding steady. The American toad is one that kind of is holding steady. We see the green frog I mentioned before kind of holding steady. Then we see some species that overall are sort of declining, it appears, like your tree frog species. Things like the pickerel frog, which is a cold stream type species. So it really runs the gamut. The ones that are super, super common still, like the American toad, that tends to seem like it's more holding steady than some of these other ones. But yeah, the ones that are rare sort of continue to be rare and experience declines.
I'm trying to remember, describe a Blanchard's cricket frog for me, would you?
Sure. They're really they're in some ways nondescript. They're very small though, so
yeah.
Adult size might be, you know, an inch, and they're kind of bumpy skinned, so they're similar in size to something like a spring peeper or a chorus frog, if you're familiar with those. Their skin tends to be a little more bumpy, and they have oftentimes, from a pattern perspective, they'll have like a different colored triangular shape between their eyes on the back of their head. So sometimes that is a way you can distinguish them from the other small frogs. They have very, very small sort of thin toes. But what one interesting characteristic about them is that they can jump. They can really, really jump far. So to the, you know, many, many orders of magnitude of what you would expect a frog should be able to jump even. So they're really cool. They have all sorts of interesting things about them. So there was research done not long ago that found that many of the individuals in a population of cricket frogs only live for 1 year. So if you can imagine a species like a frog that has to mature, reproduce, have offspring, and all of that stuff from a tadpole in a single 12-month time span. That's really, really fantastic. But it's also probably one of the reasons why they're declining, because they don't live very long on average in the wild.
Yeah. Do they croak or make a noise? Maybe Jeff can find a Blanchard cricket frog.
Yeah, if you can, that'd be great. I always liken their call to people like somebody shaking a bag of like ball bearings together, or a bunch of marbles together, or sometimes like a rain stick, if I've ever heard of, like, seen a rain stick or something. They kind of sound like that to me. But yeah, they have a very distinctive call.
Well, maybe we can find, maybe Jeff will.
Oh, there it is. There's a couple of species calling in there. So in the background, you can, there's some tree frogs calling in the background, which make it a little harder. They're kind of muddying the waters a little, but yeah, if you get a full chorus of them, so that last clip was more of a single individual, but if you get a full chorus where there's lots calling, then you get that sound of like ball bearings or marbles being banged together in a bag.
I was getting that though, from that last little piece. From that last little piece of it, that was really cool. Thanks for finding that for us, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
It very much. So what do they do when it gets cold and the ground freezes, frogs?
So the cricket frogs in particular, and this might be another reason why their numbers have declined. So some of the frogs here in Wisconsin can overwinter while completely submerged underwater, and they can absorb oxygen through their skin as long as that water is well oxygenated. Some species can overwinter on land of our frogs and can produce glycogen-based compound in their liver that helps resist ice crystals from forming inside of their cells. The cricket frogs can't do either of those. So cricket frogs are in this weird position where they can't be submerged and they also can't be fully exposed because they can't produce that protectant, that glucose from their liver. So where we tend to find them overwintering is in things like crayfish burrows along waterways. Then there's these crayfish burrows along waterways, there's a water level underground that doesn't freeze, and the cricket frog kind of migrates up and down in that tunnel as the water level goes up and down, so they can remain maybe partially submerged but still get access to oxygen. So if those types of habitats go away, then that means that cricket frogs don't have anywhere to exist in the winter. And so here in Wisconsin, we're on the edge of their geographic distribution, which always means they're kind of struggling probably anyways, just because we're at the basic edge of where they can hang on. So that might be one of the reasons as well, is if those habitats start to go away, that can affect their persistence in the state.
Josh Kapfer, our guest today, certified wildlife biologist and professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW Whitewater, as we talk with him today about herps, frogs, salamanders, snakes. We haven't got much into snakes yet, but I have some questions. There's a little disease or a problem with some of our snakes in the state I wanted to ask him about. Question for him, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, just a quick mention, we'll talk about how to be a better driver. We'll get an update on a group trying to help Madison's population become healthier. And we'll hear from a woman who sewed clothing for astronauts. How do you sew something that an astronaut's going to wear on the moon or someplace else? We'll find out tomorrow, but right now we're dealing with amphibians today on the show, among other things, with Josh Kapfer of the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, where he is a professor of biological sciences, and it's great to have him with us. Again, questions 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Lori in Oshkosh next. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's a great show. I had a question about frogs in Door County. We used to see, sometime in the spring, I believe, a whole bunch, whether it was they had, hatched or whatever, and migrated. They'd be on the roads. They'd be all over. And I don't see that anymore. So I'm wondering what that was and what might be happening. And unfortunately, I don't know what kind of frogs they were. They were pretty small.
Okay.
But we don't see that anymore. So I wondered if your guest could speak to that.
Sure.
So along the lines of what I was mentioning a little bit earlier with salamanders, frogs also have to do this migration or undertake this migration in both the spring when adults move to wetlands to breed, and then again in the fall when the juveniles, after they've transformed from larvae into adults, leave the pond and go in the uplands to overwinter. So this was likely what you're describing sounds like the situation where a bunch of adults were moving down to a wetland and there was a road that bisected where they were going, or a road between the upland and the wetland where they wanted to overwinter. And so the reason why you don't see as many anymore, there's a lot of potential reasons, but one of them could be because you saw so many on the road and there was a bunch that died due to vehicular strike. It's a very common thing where frog populations have been impacted by vehicle mortalities as part of that migration. Now, there's a lot of other factors that can influence frog declines. I mean, climate change is another one that's progressing rapidly, loss of habitat, etc. So all of these things sort of work against frog populations, which as amphibians that are very susceptible to changes in temperature and also anything in their environment that can be absorbed through their skin, then, you know, they're very susceptible to any change that might cause mortality.
Yeah. Lori, thank you for calling. Diane in Turtle Lake, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a pond on my acreage, and I'm very careful not to use any pesticides, herbicides on my land. But this pond supports some ducks, a whole bunch of frogs, and some salamanders, it seems. I have read that mosquito dunks aren't actually harmful to the animals, because I'm not a real big fan of the mosquitoes that choose to live in this pond. So are mosquito dunks safe, or are some kinds safe, some not?
Dunks?
Dunks, yeah, they're these discs that stop the mosquito larvae from hatching.
Okay.
So this is some sort of pesticide that keeps the mosquitoes in that sort of larval stage so they don't hatch, yeah. I will tell you that I am not aware of any good studies that have investigated the potential impacts on amphibians from those types of pesticides. I know they get used frequently, and I have not seen many reports of mass mortality in frogs as a result of the use of those things. But frequently, pesticides, while even if they don't cause mass mortality, something very overt and obvious that we might observe and be able to see, it's possible that there are subtle effects that we don't always see, something that maybe affects their reproductive success. Even though the frog looks healthy, it doesn't succeed in reproduction. And so it's hard to know for sure on that one, because that I am aware of, maybe there have been and I've missed them, but there haven't been good hard science investigations into the impacts that those types of things have on amphibian development, amphibian survival, and amphibian populations.
All right. Diane, thank you very much for calling. I was thinking about that. I mean, those animals, the frogs and so forth, they eat a lot of mosquitoes.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the difficulty is that, you know, in a pond that produces lots and lots and lots of mosquitoes, you know, the system sort of gets swamped, and that's what mosquitoes sort of bank on, right? And so obviously those larval amphibians, the larval salamanders particularly, larval frogs don't eat mosquitoes. They scrape algae and stuff like that from the surfaces. But the larval salamanders in particular, they do eat a lot of mosquito larvae. But, you know, whether it's enough to be a noticeable difference to you is another issue. Now, if they weren't there, you'd probably got a lot more, right? But
Greg in Madison, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hello, I have a question. I was in Hayward this summer, and we encountered a snake with a rattle. And I was told, it's not venomous, it's a constrictor, it had a replica rattle. It was either a snake or a pine snake or something. And then I've just, while I was listening now, you had mentioned two rattlesnakes. Wisconsin didn't have any venomous rattlesnakes, and now you've mentioned two down by the Mississippi, and then you just mentioned another one. So I don't know, do we have venomous rattlesnakes? And what was this rattlesnake I encountered in Hayward?
Yeah, so you wouldn't have encountered, I don't think, a rattlesnake in Hayward.
No, that's correct, Larry. There, you wouldn't have encountered a rattlesnake in Hayward. Their range, and in fact, previously the caller had mentioned Chippewa Falls, and that's also just slightly outside of the range of the timber rattlesnake, which she had mentioned. They're closer to the river, but the rattlesnake species that are found in Wisconsin are the Massasauga is one of them, and that's one that's associated with wetlands, but also today only really found in a couple handful of sites further south than Hayward. And then there's the timber rattlesnake, which is found along the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys in these sort of rocky bluff type habitats. Now, what you probably saw, if they called it a pine snake. So when my dad was growing up, he was from Neillsville, which is over by Marshfield in Clark County. And he grew up calling what is today known as an eastern fox snake. He would call that a pine snake because it hung, you know, they found it in pine plantations in the central part of the state. And so that fox snake will vibrate its tail when it's threatened. And if it happens to hit like dry grass or dry leaves, it might mimic a rattlesnake. And so that would be where the confusion lies. Now, there's a couple ways you can tell rattlesnakes from non-venomous snakes here in Wisconsin. First of all, rattlesnakes have elliptical pupils or cat's eye pupils. You can usually see that from a distance, but you don't want to get too close, obviously. Whereas our non-venomous snakes have round pupils. You can look at the head shape. A rattlesnake has more of an arrow-shaped head when looking down. But some of our non-venomous snakes, when threatened, will flatten out, and they'll get that sort of appearance to their head. So that's not always a great indicator either. But when a rattlesnake moves, it usually has the tip of its tail up in the air, like pointing straight up, and that rattle then can be vibrated as it's sort of moving away. Whereas a non-venomous snake doesn't do that. That when it's moving around, that tail is flat against the ground, generally speaking.
Greg, there you go. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Mary in Lebanon, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, I found a snake. Well, first I was shocked because it was in my basement, and I touched it with a pole, just a broom handle, to see what it was, because it thought, and then it wiggled. So then I figured I had a snake. So I put on some gloves and I just carried it outside, and it really wiggled and so on. And the only thing I can compare it to is the picture of a worm snake.
So
looked like a shoelace.
Yeah, there's. There are a couple of species here in Wisconsin that have that same kind of general appearance. Two are really, really common, and two are incredibly rare. So the worm snake is one of those that's incredibly rare. It's only known from a handful of sites here in the state. The other really rare one is the line snake, and that one was first found in 2011. We didn't even know we had it in Wisconsin until very recently. It's only known from a couple of spots. But then there are two that are pretty common. One is the brown snake, or Decay's brown snake, as it's sometimes called. Very kind of nondescript brown looking snake above, and doesn't get very big. It's about the size of maybe a big earthworm even. And then there's another one called the red-bellied snake that's also quite common. And below it has a sort of bright orangey red belly, but from up top, it's kind of a browny gray color, sort of nondescript. And so those all can get accidentally sort of mistaken for each other. So my guess would be it was either a northern brown snake or a red-bellied snake, because they also frequently will get sort of accidentally, they accidentally enter people's basements when they're looking for an overwintering spot. It's not uncommon for that to happen with those snakes.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tom and Oconto will go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. A couple other predators that you haven't mentioned. I've been doing field work in the North Woods for over 50 years, and there are lots of places where we had good populations of wood frogs, spring peepers, so forth. Once the turkeys took off, that completely changed. And if you've ever been in the woods where turkeys have hunted, especially in the spring, and you have your spring peepers and your wood frogs that overwinter terrestrially, they pick them off. Same thing with salamanders. And the other thing, especially at this time of year, I used to run a banding station where we had lots of mist nets and we were trapping hawks, but we also caught grackles. And the grackles would come through in huge flocks, sometimes over 1,000, 2,000 birds. And they'd be exploring into woods, they'd be eating grapes, all sorts of things, and they would be flying in the nets. And lo and behold, by a lot of grackles, you will find wood frogs, spring peepers, nets that they picked up in the leaves. Hmm. And so there's a lot of other predators out there.
Yeah, there I would think so. Josh, comment?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. Nobody has ever investigated this in detail, but for the turkeys in particular, that's something I've often wondered about, because there are a couple of anecdotal reports in the literature of turkeys that have been, you know, harvested and dressed during the hunting season, and the hunters have found a juvenile snake or a small snake species in their crop. And so, you know, they're big ground hunting birds. I imagine also, you know, I don't want to anger my ornithologist buddies, but sandhill cranes too, right? Yeah. They're eating tons of stuff off of the, and they're eating a lot. I mean, I've witnessed sandhill cranes eating baby red-winged blackbirds. So I imagine that they would eat a snake they found or a frog very easily. So yeah, those things are certainly predators of those types of herps.
I did want to mention the snake. There's a fungal disease of snakes that is that we have in Wisconsin, and of course a lot of other places as well.
Yes, this is the common term for this is called snake fungal disease. The scientific name is Ophidiomyces ophiodicola, and so Ophidiomyces is a fungus that. So it started to become more noticeable. I don't know if it was necessarily more prominent, but it was definitely more noticeable by researchers, you know, in the 2010, 2015 range. And some work was done on that problem here in Wisconsin, actually, headed up by researchers at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Health Center and the DNR. And I was involved in it as well, and specifically focused on some of our southern communally overwintering snake species. And so the lead researcher on that was an individual named Dr. Jeff Lorch, and he works at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Health Center. And he had explained that, you know, it doesn't behave like an emerging infectious disease. We expect an emerging infectious disease to have sort of an epicenter and then a new introduced disease and all kinds of infections spreading out from that epicenter, right? Where it was first introduced in the location. But this doesn't behave that way. More there, it sort of showed up sporadically in lots of different positions in the eastern U.S. or different locations in the eastern U.S. And so over time, there's been evidence to support that this is probably a very ubiquitous or very common fungus that exists in the soil. And as conditions change, perhaps due to climate change, that fungus becomes more of a pathogen. So there's some work that has found that snakes that overwinter in these communal hibernacula at colder temperatures have a lower instance of infection with snake fungal disease where it shows up. But if they overwinter at the warmer end of that thermal spectrum, then they have a higher instance of that fungal disease in some cases. Mm. So what that would suggest is that as climate increase, or, you know, temperature increases with climate change, maybe that fungus becomes more pathogenic and starts to cause more problems. So it's a disease that causes blisters and welts and like thickened scales and stuff to develop on these snakes. Sometimes it clears, but in really bad infections, it can cause mortality. And it's, you can treat individual snakes, but there's not like a prophylactic type of treatment to protect them in advance. And so they can get these big crusty sores on their mouths where they can't close their mouth all the way.
Can't eat.
They can't breathe well if it gets to that point. So it's it can be a very destructive disease.
And it's sad. I saw some photos of the snakes with that disease, and I felt sorry for them. Man, oh man!
It looks uncomfortable for sure.
It does indeed. Well, Boy, did we get through this and this flu this hour, Josh. Thanks.
We're good.
Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today, and let's do it again.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. And hopefully next time we can get my colleague Donald on the show as well. That would be outstanding to have us both here. Thank you very much, Larry. You are somebody that my entire family has listened to for many, many years. So I am very excited to be on the show with you.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Kapfer is certified wildlife biologist, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Madison. And when you hear him speak, you know he's very enthusiastic about his area of study, and it's always fun to talk to him, that's for sure. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our great team, Clara Niper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producers, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.